The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
This is Dan Oliver reading An Historic Rejection by Mark Brian Thomas. I suppose writers are like gamblers or fishermen. We loudly celebrate our triumphs and conveniently bury the failures. I'd made a point of mentioning a rare bit of success to an elderly neighbor of mine who also fancied himself a writer. A popular science fiction website had finally accepted one of my stories about a robot obsessed with Gustav Klimt's early paintings. And they were even going to pay for the privilege of stroking my ego. We were eating breakfast at our favorite diner when I casually let the news drop. My neighbor immediately asked me to submit one of his efforts under my name. He had offered several stories to the same website, but theorized they had been rejected unread. My new status as a contributing author would provide the entree his genius needed to be appreciated. I magnanimously agreed to look at a story, and he surprised me by immediately pulling some papers out of his jacket pocket. I read while we finished our coffee. "What do you think?" he asked. "Well," I said judiciously, "it presents some problems. This particular website specifically warns against submitting stories containing racism, chauvinism, excessive violence, or gratuitous sexual activity, and you've managed to spectacularly violate all of those norms within four pages." He pursed his lips. "One could argue they are integral to the story. Not many people truly appreciate the flavor of those times." "I suppose, but the site also has an injunction against specific overworked plot devices. The website mentions, tongue-in-cheek, of course, not to send them stories about time traveling to kill Hitler, and that's exactly what you've done." "No!" The old man was shocked. "My story is the exact opposite. Hitler's scientist, the most brilliant minds of the century, Schroeghold, Blohm, Rudolf, von Braun, have constructed a time machine in the Führer bunker, and the leader is able to escape the degradation and weakness of that era to live a life of artistic contemplation in our modern age. A bony fist hit the table and rattled our cups." I tried to be conciliatory. "Well, perhaps the publishers are just prejudiced against certain attitudes toward time travel, those that assume historical changes can be made with surgical precision. They like stories where unintended consequences overwhelm the protagonist." I returned the papers. "I'm sorry, but I just can't submit this." The old man huffed and rubbed the white patch of mustache over his quivering lip. He seemed on the verge of continuing the argument, of offering proof positive that his understanding of time and history was correct, but suddenly retreated into quiet, unobtrusive civility. "Thank you for your frankness," he said to me. "No problem." My neighbor rose and slowly walked back to his apartment while I enjoyed another cup of coffee. It was surprisingly satisfying to see life from the other side of the desk and deliver a disappointing verdict rather than receive it. One could easily get used to that sort of thing.
This is Lynn Barla, and I will be reading Half-Life by David L. Updike. You stand in front of the Major's casket at the mortuarium. He's your father, yes, but to you he'll always be the Major. Major Robert Sampson, U.S. Marine Corps, retired, and now expired, too. Semper Fidelis, faithful to the end. For the Major and his eldest daughter, The motto goes both ways. Your sisters, Sarah and Renee, are here with you. Sarah has draped herself over the casket like a flag. A black flag, no less. How utterly inappropriate. Almost blasphemous. And how like Sarah to want to own him in death, as in life. And yet, for all her wheedling, hovering, positioning, Sarah never was, and now never will be, really and truly his. No matter how much she clung to him, no matter how ostentatious her grief now, she will never know what it meant to be his chosen one. Nor will she know the terrible price it exacted, the one you paid, in the dark, night after night. Still, her histrionics are getting on your nerves. Give him some space, Sarah, you say. You're suffocating him. That isn't funny, Kate, Sarah shoots back. It isn't meant to be, you say. But of course it is funny, isn't it, given how he died. Accidental asphyxiation was the official story anyway. Please, no fighting, says Renee. Not here, not now. The middle sister, dutifully stepping into her role as peacemaker. If Renee had a motto, you think, it would be peace through weakness. Renee wants us to make nice, you say. Make nice for Daddy. Shut up, says Sarah. You smile. No one ever called him Daddy, not even when you were little kids. It was always Father or Major. But what difference did it make now? You decide to stay with it, see where it takes you. Maybe we should ask Daddy what he wants, you say. Shut up, says Renee. Oh, so now it's two against one. But Daddy should have the deciding vote, don't you think? It's his funeral, after all. Kate, shut up, shouts Sarah. Now, now, no need for an outburst, you say. It isn't respectful of the dead. You wonder if he's been listening. You've never really understood the mechanics or the metaphysics of the half-life. The explanations provided to lay people are too obtuse, too full of paradoxes and psychotronic mumbo-jumbo. Is it even really him? Or just an amalgam of stored and recovered bits and pieces that add up to something considerably less? An approximation of a human being, and a rapidly dwindling one at that. You look up at the monitor mounted atop polished steel tubes that project from the back of the coffin. Daddy, you start, feeling a little frisson of danger at addressing him this way. But what is there to say to him now? Nothing, or too much. You settle for a simple question. Do you want us here? Or are we just interfering with your journey into the afterlife? Should we just say our goodbyes and let you get on your way? You have to push the button for him to hear you, says Renee. But please don't. We shouldn't use up his time. Not yet. Why not, you say. He's finished with us. He'll want to catch up with Mom now, won't he? She has a 3-year head start, after all. You find the red button on the side of the coffin and push it. The Major's face swims up out of the dark and into focus. He looks old, skeletal, disoriented, weak. You want to shut it off before this vision of him as a vulnerable old man can replace the one you hold in your mind, where he is always solid, impermeable, a weight pressing down on you in the dark, pushing you ever deeper inside yourself. But then the clock appears at the bottom of the screen, counting down his remaining half-life. 7 minutes, 47 seconds. 7 minutes, 46 seconds. 7 minutes, 45 seconds. Better to let it run, get it over with. Speak now or forever hold your disease. Oh, it's you, he says. What do you want? He sounds tired. You step forward and ask your question, the one that burned on the end of your tongue in the dark, the one that's been corroding your soul from the inside out all these years. Why, Daddy? No answer will ever be, could ever be, sufficient. The minutes and seconds drain away, but still you wait.
This story is titled Schrodinger's Wife by Preston Grassman. Erwin stands outside the door of her house and wonders if his wife is home, not home. He has just finished another long day of theoretical discussions about cats and boxes, and he just wants to sleep. He knows that whether or not she is there depends on the observation of that morning's event. In quantum entanglement, if the measurement of one entangled particle is known, clockwise, the other will have an inverse corresponding value, counterclockwise, no matter how far apart they are. He had an argument with his wife that morning. She told him that he was too entangled in his work, that he had begun to live his life in a state of uncertainty, and that they would both be much happier if he were more certain about his life. "You're both right and wrong," he had said, "depending on the situation." What if he doesn't go inside the house, he wonders now, staring at the door. The moment he walks inside, he will know if she is there or not. Erwin opens the door. Instead of looking inside the house, he looks up the walls. The wallpaper is a vivid fuchsia, with ornate swirls and little vases. But it could also be a soft shade of red covered with the faces of women looking down at him reproachfully. He was never sure which. Of course, it could have been both. "Is anyone home?" he asks. Erwin had always liked the many-worlds interpretation because it gave less importance to the act of observation. It would mean that in one version of that day, he could walk into an empty house. "I'm in here," she says from somewhere inside. In collective collapse theory, superpositions are destroyed the moment some objective physical threshold is reached. Time, mass, temperature. "I'm in here" is a physical threshold of sound, the possibility of another world in which he could enter the house in silence, did little for him now. "It's been quite a day," he says, which could mean that it was good or bad. He walks down the hallway, thinking about a recent experiment where a beryllium ion has been trapped in a superposed state. But Erwin realized he could never be an ion. He stands outside the door of their room. Hears something inside. If he opens the door, will she be there? "There are too many doors and boxes in this world," he thinks. He slowly opens the door, wanting to postpone the observation for as long as he can. "I'm sorry about this morning," she says, lying in his bed in a tight-fitting black camisole with a cat mask. Even though Erwin can see her, he doesn't know if she is there or not. But he is certain about one thing. He is still alive.
This is Debbie Johnson and The Art of Reproduction by Megan Knoll Hart. Your legs lay on the table, one dark as soil, the other light as sand. They're both complete sets, feet still attached, a rarity even if there are only eight toes. Two little piggies will need to be deleted from that nursery rhyme. I lift your torso from the special delivery box. It's biologically male, but that's merely an aesthetic. It's secondhand like all your parts, but well cared for. I hoist it to my hip. It's weighty, already preloaded with the needed organs, but not a burden. A person's first torso should be small enough to carry, but not strong enough to support more than crawling. Newborns get into trouble if their bodies are capable of more than they understand. Our foreparents learned that the hard way. There's no skipping the dependent stages of childhood. Yet sizing up is hard on young bodies, so these parts will need to last 2 years. I squeeze your torso closer. Once my labor is over, you'll embrace me back, and I tingle with anticipation. Next, the arms. The seller lived 50 minutes from the city, but the price was worth the drive. They're thin and bruised, and the hands fell off ages ago, but that's normal. I got lucky with your feet, you see. I found free hands anyway, listed online. I bend each finger, testing the joints, all 10 delicate fingers, perfect. The seller had handed them to me as though they'd break apart if let go too soon. I spied a box of toys at the end of the hall, but the house was silent. They dropped your hands into mine as if it hurt. their child wasn't sizing up. Is it bad luck to use pieces from a child that fell apart? I kiss the tiny knuckles. I won't humor the thought further. By my will alone, you will not come undone. In a few short years, you'll have my old hands anyway, the ones I used to feed myself, to cling to my parents, to learn to draw, to create. I know it's selfish keeping such useful body parts so long for sentiment alone, but it wasn't just for me, it was for you, so that you may have something of me. The only thing I ever had of my parents is the heart that beats in me now. When I'm done with this world, you'll have that as well. What is eternity anyway, but an endless hospital stay? I found you the most beautiful eyes. One still looks cloudy, typical, but the other green as springtime. You'll only have one ear, but no one will notice with those eyes, and the hearing is still functional. Overall, it's a good head, a well-put-together face, the sloppy stitching around the nose aside. Well, now, to put it all together. Every stitch is careful, connecting the veins, the parts that will learn to speak to each other, but not to grow, not to change. My heart aches more now that you're nearly here, and I'm reminded of the pain and loneliness our ancestors must have endured when they learned that they could no longer grow children naturally. The millions who died thinking the world would be barren of a child's laugh. My labor is long and lonely. I've no partner as recommended. We've learned there was a reason for the biological insistence of two for living in families and communities. It makes things easier. Still, even with a single parent, you'll have no shortage of love. The blood tank is warm, nearly ready. To think the DNA within used to matter, the whole idea is absurd, like growing an entire child in a womb, eggs, sperm, fairy tales that once were true. I open the chest to check the heart, never trusting a package deal. It's strong. Soon it will beat. And first, your brain. This I splurged on, not for freshness or perceived intelligence. Such claims are scams. You need a dead enough brain, one that hasn't deteriorated but was left alone just enough to erase its previous life. This is the one thing you will have your entire life. It will contain you, make you so. And there will be no fragmented memories for you as there are for me. A faulty brain is no good. A faulty brain can make memories feel like real time, can bring me back to sitting on my parents' operating table. I can even feel the metal cold against my thighs. I tell my parent, I don't need an epidural. The nerves are dead in that leg, remember? They won't oblige. The new nerves work. The reattachment hurts. I force myself back to you. Your brain fits snug. The more advanced, not yet necessary portions are stored elsewhere. I'll add them once you have a bigger skull. A bigger one now would strain your neck. I suture your scalp, pump in your fluids. It is time. The machine whirls to life, electricity sparking. I've always criticized this next bit as ritual superstition, but now that you're put together before me, I'm unwilling to risk skipping it. So I call. Soul, hear me. If you are recycled, may you be worthy and welcome the security of being tethered again. If you are new, please find safe harbor here. I will guide you. I apply the shock to your body once, twice, three times, and wait. Your eyes open, the green one first, then the second. A moment of terror rushes me before you gasp, ragged and wet. The first breath of air hurts, and you wail. I scoop you into my arms and hold you, soothe you, love you. Love you more than I imagined I could love anything in this entire world. You quiet. Reach your small hand to my face. You're heavier put together. I can feel your newness, the weight of your trust, your innocence, your potential, your love. I know that this is why we live on.
World War 2.8.41 Release Notes, written by Forrest Brazil, read by Warren Keyes. The Silicon Valley Military Contracting Consortium proudly announces that World War 2.8.41 is our biggest and best war ever, bringing hundreds of new features to your favorite battlegrounds across the globe. Kablooey. SVMCC continues to disrupt the weapons industry with our latest tactical missile, the Kablooey. Kablooey can attain low Earth orbit, features a polonium-based core that can scatter radioactive fallout for thousands of miles, and pairs with any phone or smartwatch. Note that Kablooey is not and should not be considered a nuclear weapon because it is not regulated under any of those kinds of laws. Pre-fire promos. As the war continues its transition to an ad-supported model, we're proud to offer new, lower-cost automatic rifles that roll a short promotional clip before firing an actual clip. Just squeeze the trigger and look into the gun sight to view branded content from our sponsoring partners. Molotov. Chafing under an occupying force? Crowdsource your guerrilla resistance with Molotov, the gig economy app that facilitates micropayments to saboteurs and other havoc creators. Blockchain-based and completely anonymous, Molotov will absolutely be a good thing to set loose in your community. Know your enemy. The brain contents of any captured prisoners can now be uploaded to the cloud for machine learning analysis. This feature is free and completely painless, except to the prisoners. We take user privacy seriously, so even if your prisoners are later exchanged, all the data is yours to keep. World War 2.8.41 also includes significant performance improvements and upgrades to existing features, such as an all-new WHIF app with up to 60% faster alerts on the location of wind-borne mustard gas, easier access to life-saving field medics via our 8G LTE Internet of Things button, an updated code of conduct and terms of service applying to users on all sides of the conflict. We are taking substantive efforts to curb hate speech and rhetorical violence on battlefields associated with the war. Any users violating our community standards may have their weapons disabled for up to 30 days. Finally, this update to the war contains a number of important bug fixes. We've patched the AI on our obliterator strike drones. This fixes an earlier error where children between the ages of 1 and 3 were sometimes misidentified as enemy officers. Non-combatants are now classified in our facial recognition database as possible combatants. This addresses an edge case where non-combatants sometimes become combatants after being pursued for a while by obliterator drones. The notorious parsnip loophole has been fixed. Users of our food rationing app, Portion Control, will no longer be able to procure unlimited parsnips in excess of their quota. We've applied security patches to several zero-day exploits, making it slightly less likely that obliterator drones can be remotely hijacked and used against our headquarters. The scroll bar on our official homepage now works in all web browsers. As always, World War 2.8.41 is backwards compatible with previous wars, so you'll continue to enjoy the features you love, like midnight raid sirens, brain-altering propaganda, and of course, plenty of indiscriminate death and destruction. The updated war will arrive seamlessly in your neighborhood between midnight and 5 a.m., unless you are connected to someone in power. You may choose to be reminded of the update later, but that will not prevent it from happening whenever we want. Thank you for helping us make the world a better place.
Hi, this is Lynn Burla, and the story I'm going to read today is I Am Become Life by Abby Vogler. I sit on the observation deck and watch. There isn't much to see. Intermixed with the ambient night glow of the artificial city, there is a faint flash of greenish light that, had I not known it was coming, I might have missed. Behind me, the rest of the crew is buzzing, checking instruments and scanning for life. As the readings come back, the steady hum of their voices is broken by whoops and cheers. Everything has gone as planned. I take a sip of my drink. Scotch. Neat. Age 12 years. It's the last of a bottle I brought from Earth. Probably the last glass of scotch I'll ever drink. It worked, the captain says, placing a hand on the back of my chair and smiling down at me like a proud father. You say that like you didn't expect it to. He laughs. He is one of those big, hearty laughs that bureaucratic men always seem to have. I look back out across the city that, until moments ago, had never known life. I had my worries, Amy, he says. Would have been a shame to fly all the way out here and not be able to breathe the air on our new home. I nod. You were awfully sure of your fancy light, though. I nod again. You're not celebrating? Still looking out over the city lights, I hold up my drink. You science types, he begins. Without looking up, I know he's shaking his head. You invent a device that can do years worth of terraforming literally overnight, and you celebrate by drinking alone. It's really good scotch. I'm sure it is. The sound of his footsteps follows him out.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.